This is Alison Martin speaking from BAS headquarters on Wednesday, the 12th of August 1996. I'm speaking to Canon Ellis Evans and David Wynne Williams about the artifacts that were returned from Signy on the closure of Signy as a wintering base. All of the items have the accession number 1996/94.
Okay, I'm Canon Ellis Evans. I was at Signy Island from 1975 through till 1977 as a wintering freshwater microbiologist. In the second winter, I was also winter base commander.
Okay, I'm David Wynne Williams. I went down in 1974, left UK November the 7th, and arrived at Signy February the 3rd, 1975. I left in 1977. I was appointed as terrestrial microbiologist, spent two winters, three summers there, and then went back in 1980-81 season, 84-85, 87-88, and 90-91 seasons.
I've been back several times myself, but I can't remember them like that. Okay, memorabilia item one. Pomona was the replacement for Cerolis, our original work craft, and she came in 1988 and was used to support the work of the inshore marine group. It's named after a feature of the landscape on Coronation Island, the very large ice sheet, Pomona Plateau.
And that itself was named after the similar plateau in the Orkney Islands, North Orkneys.
That's right. And Pete Macko, who's associated with several of these bits of memorabilia, was a boatman of considerable note at Signy, and also a very considerable ship builder himself, that he could do all sorts of very fine work as a carpenter, and made several of these items.
And John Brooke was the biological assistant there, who used it a lot.
No, John Brooke used the Cerolis. John Brooke was down in my time,
the earlier
yours.
One.
Yeah, no, it's
delete that one.
He was on Cerolis. Yeah. But yes, Pomona and Cerolis gave us basically a facility to go rather further than we could with just the inflatables. But neither of them were absolute successes there at Signy, because they were both designed for different waters altogether, and they had great difficulty coping with the Southern Ocean. Pomona particularly had trouble there with her engines there, which were not really set up for the cold. They didn't like working in cold temperatures at all. I think that's all I can think of for Pomona. She has, as we say, gone to... she went to Stanley. It was decided that it really wasn't in our interest to send her down to Rothera when the inshore marine moved there, because she really doesn't handle... She's not designed for handling ice conditions. And so we've gone for large inshore inflatable boats, inshore lifeboat type of boats. She'll have gone to Stanley, but we don't know yet who purchased her. But that was the plan, to sell her there. The Cerolis, which is item two, was the original work craft, and actually went in my first season, in 1975-76 season. The first boatman using her was a guy called Nick Cox, who now has considerable legendary status within Bass and is the current base commander at the Nialesund station, NERC research station on Spitsbergen. He did two winters there and did quite a lot of work with Cerolis. She initially came down with an amazing A-frame on the back, and she was supposedly going to be doing coring work and pulling nets. Well, it turned out that the nets absolutely stopped her in the water. She didn't have enough power to pull those, so that was dropped very quickly, the plankton network. And the first time we tried to use the corer, We switched on the winch, and the winch proceeded to pull the boat underwater because it didn't have the capacity to lift the big Smith McIntyre grabs that we were using. So she wasn't a great success on that, and it has to be said that the way that she was had a cobbled engine in her, taken from a South Georgia boat, and it never worked very efficiently, and they ended up having to redistribute weight in the Sirolis to make her work, to cope for the fact that they'd taken the A-frame off, which made her very unseaworthy initially. When they put that weight in, she always had this bow-down attitude, and this meant she didn't travel very well through most seas. So she was a bit of a disaster for us, we have to say. But she was used for from 76 through to 88, and there was a lot of affection for her from the various boatmen. In fact, there was a very large number of them actually wanted to purchase her originally. But I gather she eventually went to the Falkland Islands, and that's the last I heard was that she was sold there, and didn't go to any of the boatmen who had been craving her.
Pete Macker wanted to buy her himself.
Indeed, Pete Macker made the models. Yeah,
but she was the one who got damaged on the ship.
That's right,
and got a hole in her on the way.
Yeah,
I think Pete lost interest then.
We used to have some amazing fun with her trying to get her ashore because she came with this amazing trolley, which took the entire base to get her up onto the slip, and she put holes in her bow on a couple of occasions because as she would come in, the tide would just move her, and she would slam into the supports at the front, and so it was always one of the hairier events trying to get her ashore or trying to launch her.
And people used to have to wait in the water at -1, you know, trying to get her onto this darn cradle.
Now, the Desmarestia is item 3, came originally from South Georgia. I don't know her history at South Georgia, but she had been there for some little while, and she was brought down to Sydney. And that would have been, as you say, it's 1964 to 76. I particularly know of her really from about 69 through to 72, that she was... there was a number of stories come out there. There's some Doug Bone, who's now part of Bass Marine Life Sciences, tells of many trips in her there over to the Coronation Island. But the most famous trip was apparently one made around 1971. I think it was around there, which had
Raybart's one, so it must have been about 71.
Jerry Light, who was then base commander, decided they were going to make a visit to the Argentinians base at Orcadas, the best part of 40 miles away on Lorry Island. And this trip was undertaken successfully. And given that the Desmarestia is just a small clinker-built dinghy and had a couple of very low-power Seagull engines as its only motive power...
And no buoyancy tanks.
No buoyancy tanks. There, it was a particularly hairy trip, which they undertook successfully. Unfortunately, having arrived at the Argentinian base and spent a little time talking with them and then duly turned around and come back, the Argentinians then released information to suggest that they had been shipwrecked, in effect, at Orcada Station and had to be rescued by the glorious Argentinian military presence at Orcada. So this caused considerable outrage amongst the British Antarctic Survey and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And the Bass staff had their knuckles wrapped rather soundly, but it has become one of the legendary trips. Suffice to say, no one has ever done a trip as long as that since.
I think Sir Vivian Fuchs said this must not be repeated. Congratulated them on the trip.
Yeah, I think so. I saw Des right at the end of her career, as you did then, and she had originally been used to do the jobs that Sirolis and Pomona did, which was basically supporting inshore marine research. And it was obvious that she really wasn't up to it for the more detailed work that they wanted to do and more extensive sampling. And so she really, in the end, ended up as a jolly boat and was used on a number of occasions there to just do sailing around the cove there when the other boats were busy. busy.
A leopard seal tried to climb into her once. I think it was Brian Kellett, and it was a very persistent one. He had to keep hitting it on the head with an oar before it lost interest. Mm. So it was very vulnerable, you know, because there are leopard seals there. They're just curious.
In fact, that reminds me of a story with Sirolis, that we went out to Sirolis and in the morning there, and we'd seen something moving around, and there had been a penguin going there in the night. And so we went out to have a look, myself and Nick Cox, and we just lifted ourselves over the side and looked in, and there was this enormous leopard seal sitting
inside
Sirolis. And we looked at each other and decided to draw straws and who was going to persuade it to leave. In the end, we both chickened out and came back and just looked at it for the best part of the day until it decided to shift itself from there. But it was one of the problems, because she used to, both the Sirolis and later the Pomona, went out on a mooring which was established in the middle of the factory cove. Yeah. And we had an outer mooring which was further out into the bay itself. Mm. And it was still referred to as the Sirolis mooring for quite a long time. Mm. Whereas we run the inflatables off running moorings there, which run off from the shore.
Mm.
And those are still used on a yearly basis. But these, depending on the weather conditions and where the wind was coming from, Sirolis or Pomona would be moved to one of these two sites. Item four is moor. Moor there is named for the sound made not by baby fur seals as they have here, but actually Weddell seals. Mm. They are some of the world's greatest actors and very, very affectionate characters. And they do make this rather lovely noise when they're talking to their mums. And Nick Cox, referred to earlier, brought in the Sirolis. He found this clinker-built boat, which had come again from South Georgia, and had no name on it. And we decided that we had to come up with a name, and he was into Weddell seals at the time, and came up with the idea of moor. And that's what it stayed with. And he did her up in our second winter? Did he do it up the winter you were there?
He started.
Right.
It was quite a long-term process.
Yeah, it was. Well, finally he did it. He actually mounted a sail on it. We put engines there on the back, seagulls, but we didn't use them. We always used sail.
Mm.
She didn't sail too well into the wind, it has to be said. But she was again used purely for entertainment. And we, a number of occasions, she rather than taking the fast trip across to Maroonga for the boat trips to do the lake work, we would take the more leisurely trip around in Moor and have a lunch there, a picnic lunch there at Stigeon, and we have sailed round nice and leisurely. It took us about 3/4 of an hour instead of about 5 minutes.
Mm. She had no keels, so she used to go sideways.
That's right, yeah. But she was never used for anything other than pure entertainment.
Mm.
And she left Sydney some years ago, 1980s mark down, yeah. I wasn't around at that time, but I think she went off to the Falklands. Most things end up in the Falklands.
That's right.
Beach, I know very little about, other than that she was sitting there. She had been used along with Desmarestia. They were more or less contemporaries. Mm. And all I ever saw was the name plaque there, because she had gone by the time I got there and
yeah,
yourself.
It was 73, because I went there in 74. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talked about.
She was, again, same style there as Desmarestia, essentially. And in fact, that might be the one inaccuracy. I would have to check whether it was Beege or Desmarestia that went to
Orcadas.
I think it was Des.
I'm pretty sure
it was the Des. But
well, it says they're the same size.
Yeah.
12 foot.
But Mr. Bowen would be able to answer that one. Number six is Sirolis. That's covered above. Number seven, Tonsberg House. I think you probably know more about that than I do.
Okay. The whaling company that operated at Sydney Island was the Tonsberg Valfangeri from Tonsberg in Norway. And the Tonsberg House was built on the foundations of the whaling factory, which was there from 1921 to 23. The whaling factory was never used in anger, or very briefly, because it took so long to dig it out after the winter. And this is something we're going to be very interested to see what happens now. This is a summer-only station. the whalers abandoned the place because you couldn't dig it out fast enough. And so by the time they got it going, it was towards the end of the season. The building was there from 1921 to 23. There are photographs of it in the Blue Photograph album, which you've probably got in archives. By the time Gordon Robin and Dick Laws were there in 47, all the outer walls had gone. You could see all the boilers, and the thing gradually disintegrated. And the big cylindrical thing on the foreshore, still at Cygne, is the steam generator that operated those boilers. There was a dormitory associated with the Stonesberg company, and a lot of the wood that was used for that was also used for building huts, possibly making Stonesberg House as well.
Although Tonsberg came in, it was actually built. No, I've seen the pictures, and Tonsberg was actually erected in UK, test erected, so everything came in. I think it might, the bits may have been used to make the connections through.
Yeah, just extras. I've got a collection of photographs. I've got a file of photographs of the building of Tonsberg House.
Yeah.
If ever you need to see those, I've got those at home. Miriam Booth gave it to me many years ago, and I've got a lot of Cygne archive stuff at home, fairly well documented. So if you need further information, I could dig that out. But there's a lot of it needs to go on computer, because when I collected all this, it was before computers.
But basically, we took the barrel stave, and they carved up Tonsberg House onto it.
That's
and that
right.
was then put up as a memory of the whaling station, which had been on the same site. But essentially was just to indicate just a memorabilia there attached to the Tonsberg House.
That's right. And the house itself was built in the 60s. A chap called Ron Pinder, who lives locally, was there.
Yes,
he's worth talking to if you want to follow that one up. Ron Pinder, P-I-N-D-E-R.
He built many things on Cygne.
That's right. And so they used the foundations of the whaling factory as a good solid base. It had a big crest on the side of a couple of elephant seals rearing up. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this, with the motto Semper in Excreta. And if your Latin is workable, you understand that one. I think it was a gin bottle in the middle.
The last wintering party of Cygne actually adopted that as their crest, which has gone on the rugby shirts.
That's right. There's an interesting story associated with this. You know, it was a very fine crest. But apparently, whoever was the senior officer here at headquarters or wherever HQ was, it was in London then, did not like this. It might have even been Sir Miles Clifford or someone like that, felt it was inappropriate to have this rather crude emblem alongside the official post office emblem, you know, which had the royal crest on and everything. So the base commander was ordered to take it down. There was a visit from a Russian ship that season, and the one of the senior men saw this crest sort of lying around, took an immediate fancy to it, and was solemnly presented with it as a souvenir. So as far as we know, it's in Moscow now. The house itself was a wooden house. It had the generator sheds at the seaward end, and then a series of offices and a met shack with a bunk in it.
That's right. And the two generators were called Snoopy and the Red Baron.
That's right.
And they were taken out in the season I went in, 75-76 season, your middle season.
I've got photographs of those coming out.
And we've then replaced them with the three Rolls-Royce generators.
Yeah. So the plaque refers to the original Tonsberg House.
Yeah. That's right. Which, in fact, is curious there, it was so well made that, well, despite being hacked around by generations of FIDs, it was still assessed by the surveyors as the best maintained building, and the one in best condition on the whole of the Cygne site. Says something for the quality of its build.
Incidentally, dating from the whaling factory days, the emergency hut, which is there at Cygne at the moment, was actually built by the whalers, and that is the original building at Cygne Island, if you like, dating from the original factory, which was the foundation of this house.
We now use that as our emergency hut, and it again is a beautifully maintained building, because they built well in those days.
And the hinges and the hasp and everything were obviously homemade by the blacksmith of the whaling station.
These other items are a bit are rather smaller scale items. Mm. They referred to individuals than being much long in tradition. The Cygne gaff there was basically presented to people there who were, they were in the marine group. There were several people at that time who used to regularly make mistakes like dropping pieces of equipment over the side of the boat just as they were about to start. And so this joke started up of having a model boat hook there, which and it was put up, and initially each year somebody's name was put alongside it, but it didn't actually go on for too far. I think
Did Dave Walton get presented with it because of the Markov?
Yes, I believe he was. Yes, the Markov.
Do you want that story now?
Well, I think we can do that later on. Okay. I was too. Yes, right, I was part of that scam.
Okay.
The Sydney Scabbard there, again, is just something that there was some people constantly lost their knives there when they went diving. They always seemed to be catching them on things and losing them. And so it was decided that they would give this empty scabbard to people there to commemorate that, their clumsiness, basically. Mm-hmm. But the significance there is that at one point in time, around the time we were there, there'd been this whaling vessel many years before had gone over onto the west coast of the island and gone in behind the Jebsen Rocks, foolishly thinking that it was going to get itself protected from the big storm that it was outrunning. And it didn't. It got itself swept into a harbour, which is now Jebsen Harbour. Mm. And it crashed up onto the shore there, and they had to abandon it. There was some suggestions, and in fact it was such a clumsy piece of work that in fact it might have been an insurance job.
That's the rumour.
Because it's really strange that the whalers knew that the only safe anchorage on Sydney is where the base is. Yeah. Anywhere else was dodgy, particularly on the west coast. But they went in anyway there, and they ran it ashore, and that was it. That got progressively crushed by the ice over the years, but it was still sitting there with lots of memorabilia, very shallow water, and it became a very popular dive site, a real wrecker's paradise, as we would dive down and retrieve pieces of it. There are things like the porthole. One of the portholes from it is still on the base, which has a nice... as a nice picture that was done in it was a pen and ink drawing of the wreck, and that's inside this, and it's all beautifully polished up brass. But various other items were taken from it, and one of the items there was this scabbard, which was found on the wreck. Lots of other items disappeared. The wreck's now completely flattened by the ice and really is nothing worth diving in. But around the 70s, it was pretty reasonable diving site. Mm. And that was at the time when diving really took off at Sydney, when we moved from doing less than 100 dives there to doing several hundred dives a year.
Mm. In those days, you could swim around the propeller and see the pipes of the boilers. The ship sank in 1912.
That's right.
And there's a description of the event written by a man called Moyes, who was a magistrate from presumably the Falklands, and he just happened to be visiting the island, inspecting whaling leases and that sort of thing. And he gives a description of these men coming over the ridge of Sydney Island from the wreck. And the reason there's this rumour about insurance is they had all their kit with them. Which seems a big coincidence if you've just been shipwrecked.
Insurance jobs were a big business there in the whaling sealing days down there.
So. And Moyes conducted a sort of investigation and a sale, actually, at the time. And I forget how much money changed hands, but it was a very small amount of money.
And in fact, Moyes' point is named for him.
Yeah. And there is a copy of that report. I've got a copy of it. It should be in the library as well.
Item 10, FS Polar Stern.
There's a plaque to her.
Yes, I don't know much about that. It appeared at a time when I wasn't on base, and it just commemorated the fact that the Polar Stern did quite a bit of work around the South Orkney Islands and became quite a regular visitor to Sydney at one time. And this was one of the first major visits that they made, and the Polar Stern handed over this bell, which Pete Mackel duly mounted onto a nice piece of wood.
Mm.
And it's hung up there. Two black and white photographs and a letter from Harry G. Haywood. Mounted together in a glazed, cracked frame. Haywood was bass leader at Base F. I don't know that.
Mm. I just went there. Dave Fletcher was base commander. And he had a box of pipes, and he had these crates of caps and cigarettes, the ones with the sailor and the beard, etc. Right. And he was trying to get us to smoke the things because he wanted to clear the loft out.
Yeah.
But they were standard issue in those days, and we also had big flagons of Pusser's Rum. It was the end of the era. You know, these are big earthenware flagons in wicker baskets. And they came with these capsicum cigarettes and pipe tobacco as well, and pipes.
The one didn't get you, the other certainly would.
Yeah, and we still refer to coffee as smoko, and it's the Royal Navy tradition, and what they used to do was knock off for a puff at a pipe and have a coffee at the same time.
That actually does remind me. These capsicum cigarettes did turn up. Most of the huts, when I went down in the 70s, would have tins of those sitting there. Nobody... Nobody on base, bar Mal Dry, who was the radio operator, came in. He was an ex-RAF radio operator, came into Sydney in my second winter, and he was the only smoker on the base, and he proceeded to smoke the entire allocation for the base of cigarettes and was reduced to smoking these things by the end. So he went through quite a few of them. But they turned up at an awful lot of the field huts in the early days and then got steadily cleared out as we just really weren't a smoking base. But that's interesting at that point, is that the Tonsberg House, when it was built, the sleeping accommodation was not in the main building. It was up above it in the attic. The loft space was actually the sleeping quarters for everybody. And subsequently, it got used on a more intermittent basis in the summer when we went up over 30 people and had nowhere to sleep, and so we'd sleep a few up there. But generally, it steadily developed into becoming the food store. And this enormous food store was set up there, which was constituted of phenomenal weight for a building which was never designed to handle that. And we were always wondering whether we were going to put one tin too many into it. And down at one end was always the goodies areas, which are these special goodies boxes, entertainment boxes that come in, and things like the cigarettes and so forth were all stored down there at one time. Item 13 is the Soviet merchant ships booklet, which basically we get a lot of Soviet ships, Eastern Bloc ships would come down, particularly fishing fleets would come down, and it was... We were given instructions from London, as it was originally, that we should always try and identify these ships and make a note of them and report that back to UK. And so this stayed on base endlessly there to pull these out. There was this famous scam that was worked on one occasion there where we had a number of worthy senior members of BAS staff on the base, and this radio message came in rather crackled and disturbed, saying that the academic Markov was in the vicinity and could they come in and visit the base, and was there a senior scientist on the base and could they come to the radio and tell the ship about what sort of things they were doing, and that the ship was moving towards Sydney and was hoping to arrive at some point in time. This we unfortunately involved Dr. David Walton, and there was also Dr. Martin White were on base at the time, plus myself, and various people were brought in to speak to them. Several of us started to smell a rat there when a couple of phrases which should only have been known to Sydney people turned up in the Markov's conversations, and we became very, very suspicious and started to back off. But Dr. Walton, not being a Sydney man but a South Georgia man, was not aware and proceeded to give a very detailed breakdown of what was being done at the base and what was being done by BAS as a whole, and didn't even pick up there on the fact that they'd actually called him by his nickname at one point. Thought that he'd actually misheard this. Of course, what it turned out was that the electrician, I think it was the electrician and the diesel mechanic had set up a radio in the Jenny shed and were actually broadcasting from there. And eventually you had to just admit it was very much like one of these television programs where, you know, they come up and admit what it was, and there was great embarrassment all round.
Beagles about,
yes. It became quite a story from that season. USARP, I know that was on base when I arrived. That is an old That is an old, old...
Manhattan.
The Manhattan came in there. It's
She's an old ship, very
late 60s, I would
71.
Say. 71, yeah. It was certainly, it was just one of the visiting ships. I haven't got any information on that. Antarctica, the record of sounds of Antarctica
by
Ed Mickleborough. Now, Ed Mickleborough was a Met man at Sydney back in the 60s. And he then went off and carved out a career for himself as a cameraman. And was very interested in polar regions. And he came down to make a film about Antarctica and recorded a lot of sounds of animals whilst he was there. And he turned this into a record, which we then had a copy on base. Some of it is very, very good indeed. He came back subsequently and did more work when the John Biscoe film was made. He was involved on the base at that time, by which time he'd outstayed his welcome, I think. He came around photographing. He did underwater photography for the BBC, and then he also was making his own film about Sydney Island, I think particularly the penguins. And so he's subsequently moved to Scotland and has done several films on Scottish topics. But I haven't heard a lot of him in the last 5 or 10 years now.
Me neither. He insisted on clearing up the base before he started filming because it was a bit of a tip, so he was responsible for making the place look respectable. He did a good job from that point of view.
Sydney plans the base buildings. Not much on that.
Okay, Greenpeace, self-explanatory.
USARP. No.
Polish Academy of Sciences.
Henrik Artowski Antarctic Station. That's the station on King George Island. But I think that this was in fact given to us by scientists who were on one of their marine cruise ships. They had a number of the Soviets as well had a large number of research vessels in support of their fishing activities. And I think that that reflects a visit by one of these Soviet bloc research vessels. Badger. I was down in 1994 at Sydney, and we woke up one morning to the smell of a wood-burning stove. coal-burning stove, which, of course, has not existed at Sydney since 1975, when they took out the old coal-burning stove and put in the magnificent double arger. That was the other thing that came in with Sir Rolis.
Yes,
was
right.
The new argers were put in, which have now finished their... They're not going to be used in the new summer base. So they run from 1975 through to 1996. We woke up to this smell, looked outside, and there was this yacht with a Chinese junk rig on it. Very peculiar. An English couple from Lancashire. He was a boat builder, she was a civil servant, and raised the money, which basically they've been using ever since. They built the boat, and they've been living off that money for the last 10 years, cruising the world. They had just been down in the Falklands, staying with the Ponces, and they decided they were on their way to South Africa, and they came across to us. Very rare that we get much in the way of yachts our way, but they came across to us, and they were then going on to South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands before heading over to South Africa. They are great collectors of rum. They had this amazing book where they would find different rums and try them out on friends. And there was a whole series of comments. There was well over 100 different rums that they had tried in their many years of travelling. Particularly, they spent a long time in the Caribbean. And they were fantastic knowledge they had on rums. And we drank quite a bit of it, variety of it, on a couple of memorable evenings on board. But they organised trips. They're all on Christmas Day. a number of people went on the boat and were sailed up the coast of Coronation and back. And they stayed with us for about 5 or 6 days before moving on. Very nice couple.
Next one.
This is
Iceberg. David Lewis.
David Lewis of Australia.
Yep, circumnavigated the Antarctic. Got turned over a couple of times, lost his mast, had to be not actually rescued. He limped into Palmer Station, the American base, and they set him up with a new mast. And I think he came from Palmer to Sydney. And it was before I
went. That's right,
he did. It must have been 1972, 73?
Yeah, something early 70s.
Mm. And he visited Sydney Island, just a social visit.
It's actually mentioned in his book.
Yep.
Yeah. But he came in. I should say this other one, the Inverness Yacht Club, it's faded here, but this is the Awani. This is the Awani. Before my time, it was 1971, but there we had the picture of her. And again, it was one of these rare occasions when a yacht decided to visit Sydney Island. Mm. South Orkneys are really off the yachter's route, and we are a long way from anywhere. So these are quite rare and important events as far as we were concerned, where some of the bigger ships can take or leave.
Have you got comments of all the ships?
Yeah, you got all of them.
Very quite dramatic. Came for a visit. I've got some cine film of her sailing.
My name her again.
Oh, the Shackleton. This is the Royal Research Ship Shackleton. She was a Nurk ship, not a Bass ship. The most revolting colour. It was sort of a rusty orange hull.
Cute
green superstructure.
Cute green superstructure, really revolting. Yeah.
I've got some cine film of her sailing in. She had a stern sail, a little mast, and they used to save fuel by sailing in every now and then. And no, hang on.
No, that's Hero. That's Hero.
Forget that. But Shackleton came in, social visit, and Philip Warne was the captain. And he came ashore with all the rest of the lads. Very humble man. I just happened to be taking him for a walk. And I didn't know who he was. He wasn't in uniform at the time. And I asked him what his specialty was. And he said, oh, I'm the captain. Just as humble as that. But he then had a saga leaving Sydney, going back to Port Stanley, because he was intercepted by the Argentinians.
An Argentinian destroyer.
That's right. And because the ship was called the Shackleton, the Argies were under the impression that Lord Shackleton was on board. And it was in the days of delicate politics. And the Argentinian captain commanded him to stop engines. And Philip Warren refused. He said, I'm on the high seas, you have no right to intercept me. And the Argentine captain repeated this warning and said, I'll fire a warning shot across your bows. And Philip said, you have no right to stop me. And then you hear, boom, boom. There's a tape of this, because the first mate recorded this. He whipped a cassette recorder out, plonked it on the binnacle, and tape recorded the conversation. And you can hear the shells being fired across the bow. So Philip did eventually take the hint. And then the captain said, you will be escorted by me to an Argentinian port. Which port do you wish to go to? And Philip very quickly said, take me to Port Stanley. Because the Argentinians claimed it as an Argentinian port, and that's where he was going anyway.
Yeah.
And thereby he avoided a diplomatic incident, because the Argentinian had no alternative to that.
The other point was is that they stopped shelling, wasn't there? Was that he said that he actually had a ship full of explosives.
Mm.
And whilst they wanted to stop them, they didn't want the risk that their shelling wouldn't be accurate enough and they might hit the ship. And then it was full of explosives for seismic work, I suppose, assume.
Right.
And that would have blown the ship up. So that would have been very embarrassing for them. And so he actually stopped them shelling from that.
That's right. But that was quite an important story. It had all sorts of implications. The other one I got confused with for a moment was the Hero, number 10.
Yes.
The research vessel Hero. She came in when I was there, 1977. And she did sail in. She had a little mast.
She had a little mast on the stern. They used to keep her bow into the sea there when she was coming along. Yeah,
that's right. And she was a wooden ship, sheathed in Greenheart, just
sheathed
like the old
Greenheart,
Terra Nova and Discovery and so on. And she eventually was abandoned because she got the Teredo worm. She got the woodworm, which finished off a lot of ships.
She used to run out of Ushuaia.
Mm.
They operated out of Ushuaia down to Palmer Station. And in fact, the time I came down, in the mid-70s, Bransfield was doing the relief of Palmer Station because, really, Hero couldn't take enough cargo for her. Which meant that we actually, in the early days, had this wonderful trip. You had the same thing, but your ship broke down. that we went across to Jacksonville, a marine, it's a naval establishment there on the coast of Florida. And we'd go over there, load up with cargo, and then sail down through the Caribbean and down the coast of Brazil and all the rest of it, a very, very exotic trip, and do the relief of Palmer Station before coming up to do the relief of Sydney. And then traditionally in those days, we didn't go in as we do now in November time into Sydney. The first relief was actually in January. It was much, much later.
Mm. Can I just refer back to the Walter Herwig and the Weser, two German ships?
Yes.
The Walter Herwig was officially a research ship, and the Weser was one of these deep-sea trawlers. And the Ehrwig, as we used to call her, was full of computers and all sorts of electronic gadgetry for finding krill.
Yeah. She was the pre-Polar Stern.
That's right, and it was in the early days of research for krill in that area. And the captain of the Weser didn't have any sophisticated kit, but he had a lifetime of experience. And when they were working in the waters around Sydney Island, it was the Weser that always caught the krill, because the captain's nose was much more efficient than any of the computers. And they actually gave us krill, and we had krill on toast. They had a krill factory actually built into the ship.
Yeah, and we had curried krill. And the Julius Fock, item 5, came in 2 years later in a follow-up piece of work where they had a lot of technologists on board trying to find a way to make krill appetizing.
Hmm. Admiralty, what would that be? Number 6.
I don't know what that is. It's Admiralty Bazaar.
I wonder if it's San Martin.
No, San Martin is further down. Yes. So here's the San Martin.
Okay.
The San Martin came.
Oh, hang on. Yes, not a yacht.
No, this is yachts. yachts is the next okay, category, but it's Argentine Navy.
Yep.
And the San Martin was an ex. A United States Coast Guard icebreaking vessel worked the Arctic, and they sold her. She was quite small, and they sold her to the Argentinians, who well passed her sell-by date, we thought. And she came in stacked full of Argentinians in my middle winter. So that is the 76-77 summer season. We were waiting for John Biscoe to come in, and she turned up. It's the only time she ever came to Sydney. And she came in as apparently saying that she didn't think the base was occupied. Well, there was obviously a flag and smoke coming out, so it was a bit of a joke. And the two of us were spotted her because we were out digging out the base at the time. And she came ashore, and she'd hit some rocks, and she was effectively trying to say that we had put the rocks there and we should have marked them on the map. Well, of course, the whole area is full of old rocks there, which lurky rocks, which people don't have on the bathymetric naval charts. And she came ashore, and that's where they had the classic case where they went and put in that landing craft at the end of the jetty, and we said, we're on springs. So the tide will go out beyond the end of the jetty and you'll be grounded. And they just said, yes, there, and ignored us. And sure enough, absolutely high and dry, never seen such a low tide.
We could walk around the boat.
Yeah, walk around the boat. And suddenly they all decided that they wanted to go back onto the ship, onto the San Martin. And of course they couldn't do it because this was caught. And so they were sitting around, and of course there is the captain was one. Then had the admiral of the overall fleet was another character, and then you had the commander of the marine contingent. Mm. And all three were talking into radios which were simultaneously, which weren't working properly because seawater got into them. And then they went in and used our radio and were talking simultaneously into our one radio trying to get through. And it was a great joke. There's many photographs were taken of her and the great embarrassment of the Argentine Navy. Mm. She never came back. I don't think... Yeah, the Nevny, there was a Polish, that's item 19. She was actually a Soviet fleet, but she was a Polish vessel, and she was effectively a fishing vessel, really, wasn't she?
Mm.
And she came in and visited there in the time of Martin White, which I think is late 60s and early 70s. And she came ashore and made a visit there whilst they were there in the middle of a marine cruise that they were doing.
Mm.
And it's from that the famous Svetlana's passage is derived. But that's another story which we won't go into here.
Won't put on tape.
Ioanni Sangiseppi Due. Do you want to...
I don't remember that.
All I know about that was that this was
before I came.
It was The first Italian expedition to the Antarctic. She was actually, she had motor power, but essentially she was a three-masted vessel there with almost sort of Arab Latin sails.
Mm.
And she sailed down, and apparently there was just, it was a constant Latin arguments. And they basically ended up that the crew and the scientists and thing were all in total disagreement with the captain and leader of the expedition.
That was South Georgia, wasn't it?
Yes. They mutinied when they got to South Georgia. Yeah. And apparently they never really got to do anything much at all. But they obviously made it down to the South Orkneys, made the visit. But we've never heard sight and sound of what happened to them afterwards.
Mm. Lindblad Explorer. That should be Lindblad, not Lindbald.
Yeah.
She went down, when I first went down, and John Green was on board. John Green was SECFIDS, you know, the original sort of administrative officer in Stanley, I think it was based. The legendary stories about John. He was down as one of these guides. I'll just tell you one story, just that it does go on tape somewhere. It was a story Eric Salmon told me, which is a classic. John was also the Commander-in-Chief of the Falkland Islands Defence Force, and he was down there when the Duke of Edinburgh did the Royal Tour in Britannia. And John was in his full dress uniform waiting for the Duke of Edinburgh, and this dress uniform included dress cords, you know, these long tassel things. And the Duke wasn't due for about an hour, and John was sitting in his office with his feet on the desk and a drawer open, and this is all relevant. The Duke came early, walked into his office. John tried to jump to his feet. As he jumped to his feet, his dress cords went into the drawer, which then slammed shut. And as he stood up, he got halfway up and then nearly strangled on his dress cords. And Prince Philip took one look at him and said, "Would you like me to go out and come in again?" That was John Green, and he came down to Signy as one of the original guides in the early days of tourism. This was a particularly relevant visit, because in those days, tourist ships were, well, I think it was the only one, about 80 people on board.
Right. The other, item 27...
Can I stop you there?
Okay. Item 27 in the photographs is Damien II from 1984. Damien has made several visits to Signy over the years. Damien I was originally crewed by...
Jérôme and Sally Posse.
No, Damien I was crewed by Jérôme and his brother. And came down and made the first trip down and then wrote a book about yachting in the Antarctic, which then some people took as a... what was that? What would be the term for it?
Oh, you're thinking of the Brazil. There was another one called the Bazile. No. The guy who sailed that wrote The Looter's Guide to South Georgia. Is that what you're thinking of?
No, your man wrote The Looter's Guide to the Antarctic, basically. That's what you're thinking of, yes.
Oh.
But basically, he came. Jérôme wrote this thing with his brother, and he also made a film about it. Mm. Subsequently, at that trip, he met up with Sally in Australia and married her. Mm. And they then purchased the Damien II, a much more seaworthy craft altogether. Mm. I should say that Jérôme has a reputation as being one of the great yachtsmen of the world.
Yeah.
He has a phenomenal reputation worldwide, done a lot of long-distance work. They're based largely now on... they've bought an island in the Falklands.
Mm.
I forget the name of it now. And they're living there with their various kids, a couple of whom have been born in the Antarctic, or brought up, yes. The one was actually born while they overwintered at Horseshoe Island, if I remember rightly.
No, it was somewhere at South G, because the child had to be registered.
Yeah.
And the base commander was the magistrate, didn't have any birth records. So little Dion's passport says he's SG1. SG1 is the number. Now, the interesting thing was Sally had him at Leith Harbour, I think. I think that was that.
That's
one.
That's right.
They were obviously operating around Grytviken, but they didn't want to inconvenience the base, so they sailed round to Leith, and she had little Dion. I think it was Dion.
Yeah. I thought that they actually had one. She produced one while they were wintering. They overwintered at the old British base of Horseshoe Bay, down in Marguerite Bay. Horseshoe Island, not Horseshoe Bay, I should say. And they certainly overwintered there with Damien. there, and I thought that she produced while he was there. But anyway,
that's one to check up on.
But certainly, they came in on a trip there. They came in to us in 1984, and they actually had some people who were from... There was a guy from South Georgia, Bird Island, who was later involved in that book with the Waltons.
Oh,
and
yes.
And
Chap called Copestake.
That's right. There's Paul Copestake.
Paul Copestake
was involved. And there was another guy then, who, a young lad who I've seen subsequently, who was making a film. And he was down anyway, and he was a Bird Island person.
Okay.
But whatever, they came in, and they... Jerome has a habit of going into every bay, everywhere. That's his big... the big thing he has got over everybody else. He has virtually sailed into every cove you can go into in South Georgia and the peninsula. And he knows them very intimately. But he has banged his yacht several times doing so. Steel hull. Mm. Right. He hit something the same way the San Martin hit something on the way to Sydney. Mm. A spike just came up from nowhere, and he hit that. And he started finding oil getting into their water supplies. So they came across to Sydney, and we actually tipped the yacht over onto the slip. Mm. And we have the pictures of her tipped over on the slip, which in fact we put a few more dents into her in doing that. And the base diesel mechanic then went down with his oxyacetylene torch and sealed up the appropriate leaks there and sorted it out. And we then had them around for a few days where, again, they took various members of the base out at various times for trips down the coast. Very, very pleasant it was as well.
And Bass has it sometime chartered?
They've chartered Damien, particularly the birds and seals people, but also the geologists chartered her.
Mm.
She's a particularly good craft for getting in and supporting small field parties there in isolated positions. And it's worked very effectively. And for doing things like the survey, the seal survey around South Georgia, the only way you can do it is to get very close into shore and just slowly work your way past counting them. You can't go ashore. You work it from the boats. And she's perfect for that, and he knows so much about those waters. He knows more about it than any other living person, I would say. Mm-hmm. So he's perfect for that. Mm-hmm. All of these are modern affairs.
Yeah.
These, I don't know much on these pictures.
Them.
But there is this, which relates to you. Item 52 in this landscapes, Coronation Island from Sydney Island Panorama, and also item 53, Coronation Island from Sydney Island Panorama, two layers.
Hmm.
And that's your panoramas that you've made.
That's right. So that was 1975, 76.
Yeah, been that.
And I took this panorama, but when I stuck it all together, it was too big to get home, so I donated it to the base. And one of the people mounted it and put it on display. It was taken from Tioga. And it's a view of the whole of Coronation Island.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
You got any idea what that is?
No. Don't remember that.
I'm trying to remember when the military came down. They used to come down to help with South Georgia.
No, for Singapore.
Singapore. No.
I just don't know.
That wasn't on the base when we were there.
Mm.
That has come in subsequently. Mm. And I'm trying to think what activities would have resulted in a military group coming in.
It could have been endurance. Endurance.
Yeah.
And then that's the Falkland Islands Provost.
Yes, that's right. And the Provost unit presumably is military police.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes, it says Royal Military Police. Okay, so that
I would have said it was post-Falklands.
Post-Falklands, yeah.
Yeah, post-Falklands.
Okay.
R.S. James Clark Ross on the... her first visit to Sydney.
Yep.
Her adventure.
And this, I think I must have brought this back after my season 1982-83. I went down as a guest scientist with NSARP, as it was in those days, New Zealand Antarctic Research Programme, and I took a Bass plaque down, and I think that they probably gave me this in return. And so the next time I was at Sydney, which would have been 84-85, I presented this. USARP, that was the visit of the hero we were talking
One
about.
One of the many visits of the hero. Yeah. That was on base when I, before I arrived.
Yeah, it must have been that first year I was there. She came in under sail.
She used to do a lot of work there supporting geology parties. They would the Americans are quite active working the South Orkneys at one point in time.
Just remembered a classic story. Good one. Janet Thompson, now running the map department.
That was the story I had in mind.
Okay. Mike had been coming down with Bass for many years as a geologist. Janet is a geologist in her own right, but was not allowed to come down with Bass because she was a woman. So she decided she was going south, and if the Brits wouldn't take her, the Americans could. So she managed to negotiate a place with an American research team, and she came down to Signal Island, a British base, on an American ship. And I remember she'd been ashore, and I was going to visit the ship, and the person in front of me going up the rope ladder had a pair of nylons on. And I felt that only men wear nylons, you know. But of course the rest of her kit was full Antarctic kit, so it could have been anyone. And I suddenly realised I was climbing the ladder behind Janet Thompson, who had come down as a guest.
The interesting thing was I came in to the base lounge at that point in time and found virtually the entire base behind the bar, as if they'd been cornered by something. And they were all behind the bar, drinking quietly. And over in the corner, where the hi-fi was, there were two enormous American Marines, absolute giants there, all clad in their polar gear. And between them, this very diminutive, boy-like thing. And Nick Cox, again, it was always Nick seemed to be the one, said, "Cannon, that's a woman." And the base really didn't know quite what to make of it there. We'd had a long winter there, male only.
Two and a half years is a long time.
They really didn't know quite how to handle it. And apparently the Americans didn't know quite how we'd handle it. And therefore put these two enormous Marines, the bodyguard. She didn't need that looking after, but it was quite a story.
Absolutely, that was hero, wasn't it?
There's a whole series now of ones which basically reflect the interest of the Germans in the South Orkneys. They've done a lot of work, particularly to the north of the South Orkneys, and so have the various Herwig and Meteor, the Herwig and the Weser.
Yeah.
Their work that we haven't got one is actually the Herwig and the Julius Fock came down. The first one was this Herwig Weser, and then there was Julius Fock and Herwig, and then we had the Meteor and the Herwig. And then subsequently, we had when the new Polar Stern came in, they're all singing and dancing German vessel, the Herwig again came down in support in 1983-85. So there's a continuous record of German visits to the area. And initially, in the early days, they used to actually come in and they'd have a couple of days sitting off the base, and we would go on board and they would come ashore and we would take them around Shawmar sites and the rest of it, and we'd go on board and seem to drink a lot of schnapps, as I remember.
Yeah, Jägermeister.
Yes, very worrying. But subsequently, when they got the big Polish Stern, she tended to stay out most of the time. She came in on one occasion at any rate, but more often than not, she was to the north and would just fly a helicopter over, usually with some rather nice German beer on it, and would just make a social call. And that's how some of these have come in. The Giuseppe Due there is a follow-on from what we said earlier. The other thing that we've had a lot of are things like the Lindblad Explorer and the World Discoverer. There's been a long tradition of both those ships coming down to the South Orkneys. And in the early days, we did initially let them come ashore at Signy as the way they did at Faraday. But eventually we decided that, in fact, the whole of our island was really a study site, and we couldn't afford to have these numbers of people coming in regularly and tramping across to the areas where they wanted to look at penguins and the like. And they took over the base when they did it as well.
These are
tourist ships that were coming in. So what we had decided in the end was that we would offer them an area over on Coronation Island, which has fantastic scenery. You're sitting underneath the Sunshine Glacier. It's a magnificent glacier. And there was a nice little field hut in Shingle Cove, which they could go and have a look at, a bit of history there. And there was a few penguins and seals and nice safe anchorage for them. And they've really got the impression now that Cygni is a research island and is not to be touched. And for years now, all of the research vessels since the Discoverer and the Lindblad have consistently gone to this Shingle Cove area.
And the tradition is we go on board the ship, you know, they send a launch for us, and then we give them a slideshow as we sail over to Shingle. So by the time they actually arrive and drop anchor, they're right up to speed as to what we're doing, you know, and who we are and how we go about things, and also about the wildlife they're going to see. They're very well briefed. And something I've discovered they still do is they play a cassette, which I made in 1980, of a conversation with Cygni Cyrilla. I don't know if you know, but the story of Cygni Island itself, it was charted by Captain Petter Cyrilla, who was a Norwegian whaling captain. And he was the guy who invented the stern slip in the big whaling factory ships, which actually finish off the whales. Anyway, he named Cygni Island after his wife, who would only have been about 1920-ish at the time. 20 years old. And this was about 1915.
And several offshore rocks are named after his daughters.
Yeah, Gerd Island is named after Gerd Strenger, who is still alive and well and full of fun.
Who came along to the 40th anniversary and of Cygni.
Looking forward to the 50th as well.
Yeah,
and, quite a girl. Anyway, I went up to visit Cygni Cyrilla herself, who was an old lady over 90 in 1980. And I just tape-recorded a little conversation with her and Gerd Strenger, her daughter. And I gave a copy of this to the Lindblad, and they use this, they actually play it to sort of put the history of the island in perspective as well as the wildlife.
I think you'd see there that, as you say, it's the Discoverer and so forth has given plaques. Now we move them across to Coronation Island. We don't get the plaques because they don't come ashore, so we don't have these exchanges. And so most of the reference you see to cruise ships are from photographs that we've taken. There was much more of a tradition with some of these earlier plaques there of the ships coming in and actually visiting the bases.
Yeah, the Orgazes connection is an interesting one. It's a delicate one. Sometimes you have a radio operator at Orgazes who speaks good English, or someone on base who speaks good Spanish, and they have a really good season. And then other seasons, there's just no communication whatsoever.
Or
they're a purely military base.
They're politically told, you know, they should not communicate with us. But they are. It's all military personnel. They have a fence around the base, so people don't go outside that territory. They sit on a low-lying beach, isn't it? In effect, is where they've got. It's a peninsula, like a big point, and they just live within that. They just do Met. Mm. They don't do anything else. And it's military personnel, and we know that they do get aircraft visits.
C-130s.
And every once in a while, you can hear the noise of the C-130s. It tends to come in on the north side of Coronation, so we don't see it too often.
Mm.
But that's the only sort of contact we have with them, really.
It's a strange situation because we have a very strong collaboration running with the University of Buenos Aires and the Institute of Antarctica via a whole string of people now. Gustavo Ferreira is the head of biology at Instituto Antartico, and he's very keen on collaborating with Bass.
But we are talking about the military.
That's
really,
right.
Isn't it? That's the difference.
Yeah, and we get on fine with the scientists. I mean, as many as 8 scientists we collaborate with directly or indirectly now get on fine with them, but the military we have to handle with kid gloves. It's a sad situation. They despair as much as we do. So that's 2 plaques from them.
Yeah.
The story is Bruce led the Scottish National Antarctic Expedition to the South Orkneys in 1901 to 1904. And at the end of his expedition, he offered the meteorological station that he'd established to the British government. And the British government said they weren't interested. So he then went to Buenos Aires and offered the place to the Argentinians. They said, yes, please. And they've been operating it ever since. So they are over 40 years ahead of us in terms of the claim.
Because
in Orcadas. Because the British government was so narrow-minded, they couldn't see the point of a Met station in the Antarctic. So if it ever comes to a political barney in the South Orkneys, the Argentinians have got us licked because of the government's stupidity.
The interesting point, though, is that from a scientific point of view, Laurie Island has turned out to be far less interesting than Cygni Island. Cygni Island is definitely the best place for doing the sort of work that we've been doing.
For the biology.
And so, you know, in the end, we actually went to the right place, even though we didn't necessarily go there for that reason.
That's right.
But we wouldn't have gone to Laurie Island since the Argentinians were there.
No.
What else?
East Wind. East Wind was a big icebreaker Charles Rithenberg had a photograph of her.
Yeah, was it,
the
there was East Wing.
North
Wing. Right, there's East Wing, North Wing, South Wing, all the rest of them. Yeah.
Huge things. And they must have had a visit. Oh, it was 1967. It was before our time.
We never saw them.
Nope.
Never saw those.
Penguin Encounter, SeaWorld.
I suspect that this is actually from one of the cruise ships.
Yeah, I think so.
And that somebody came in. You know, we often had people, you'd have people like, you know, penguin or seal experts from America working at one of these places, and they would bring their plaque along. They came along as lecturers on board the ship, and I think that's where that came from.
Yeah.
Because I don't recall it being down there when I first.
I haven't seen it.
In south, so I think it must be. We've had a lot more tourist ships.
SeaWorld is actually a tourist attraction.
Exactly.
That's right.
And I suspect it may be that that's a noted scientist from there has come on the cruise ships.
It might well have been Frank Todd. Frank Todd went south when I first went south in 1974. Mm. He was supposed to be going south for a fortnight to Palmer Station to collect penguins. And because we had all sorts of engine trouble, well, no, it wasn't engine trouble, it was rudder post trouble, because we had a hurricane in the Bay of Biscay, nowhere near the Antarctic. The ship was in dry dock for 3 weeks in Baltimore. And then there were so many holds-ups. He was south for about a month and a half or something. I remember him being furious at the time. But he was the guy who got this penguin encounter going. He collected the original penguins and then started breeding them. So now they don't need to collect penguins, they've just got their own eggs. So it might well have been Frank Todd, I think. Okay, when I was down there, the 1975-77 stretch, Julian Priddle did one. There must have been two of them.
He did a winter magazine called, and it was called Groans.
Oh, there was. Well, that must have been a different one, because he actually did a midwinter mag, which was just the Sydney midwinter magazine with articles. He invited articles.
Yeah.
And there was Scott's Last Jolly. Nick Cox did a skit, Scott's Last Jolly.
And I think I did one on Idi Amin, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, I did a sort of serious one about the sounds of the Antarctic. I got really quite poetic about it, you know, the sounds of wind and animals. And
therefore got a lot of stick.
Not really the sort of
I think I was linking through the mutts, the chin...
Yes,
pink, wasn't it? It was pink. Was there. We had the various mutts which are the
sheathbills
around the base in winter.
Landbirds.
The king of these mutts was we'd called Pink.
Because he had a pink ring.
He had a pink ring on him, yeah. And I went and likened him to Idi Amin did a skit on that. Yeah. And there was, you say, Scott's Jolly.
And the Silver Mucluck. Julian did that.
Yes.
Cinderella and the Silver Mucluck.
Yeah. Because we then came up there the following year, we did one of these, and myself and Nick Cox wrote Little Red Sledging Anorak Goes to Foca, which was a skit on Little Red Riding Hood, and the wolf was replaced by a leopard seal.
Right.
Things like this, yes. But
there was a lot of culture, you know, sort of culture in terms of tradition on the base, and that's one of the things I feel very strongly about. We had lots of rituals, like the making of the midwinter presents.
I've just suddenly remembered it now. That's how it went, was that you had a midwinter magazine which sometimes came out. It was very much hit and miss as to whether it came up each year. And then Groans was basically pictures of everybody on the base put together in a skittish manner. Mm. And so they would take a person and they would try to take some of the elements of their character and use cutouts from magazines, wasn't it? They cut out things there, and they would then start putting rather rude comments about them and the rest. And that was the way they used to do it. We used to have you'd have a couple of pages devoted to each person. And so everybody had their character assassinated, basically, there. And that was the Groans. And Groans had died. They'd been there in the 60s, and they died at one in the 70s. And towards the end of the 70s, we started them up again. And they seem to have disappeared once more into the... It's one of the things about bases is that what happens with the base is not tied down firmly. Mm. It depends on the personalities and therefore evolves all the time. Like the fact now that they don't dress up for Saturdays and things decided a few years ago. Well, that was a big thing for us. It's not for them. Mm. So things used to dress up in UK clothes. For a Saturday.
Just respectable clothes. You know,
the major feature is that when you're down in the Antarctic, it's very easy to lose track of time. Mm. And we felt it was important to establish that a week had come to a close, and so you could actually mark time. that way. And this, the way we did it was to have a special meal on a Saturday. Mm. Usually some wine was lobbed by the gash man. And we'd eat a little later. There was a bit better meal again would be done, usually to candlelight. And we would, you know, it's just rags. And we're, instead of having the meal and going back to the office, we'd dressed up in UK gear rather than the fit gear we normally would wear during the week. And instead of going back to the office or the lab there to do more work, we'd actually sit around with a candlelight and everything and just talk. And somebody, depending how it went, yes, how much drink got inside. And we would be doing, you know, be at the bridge club would be meeting there, or there'd be somebody playing some chess, and we'd have some music on, whatever.
Names off,
and it was just a social evening to mark the week. The tendency has been now that since videos and so forth have come in, those sort of structures are gone. Because that's another feature, isn't it? When we went down in the 70s, there wasn't any movies or anything available. What happened is when a ship came in, if the sea was right, they would bring their projector ashore and they would show us a film.
Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, seen three times in one night. It's on television next week.
Is it? Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh,
watch it. Yeah. Get all the key phrases.
We all fell in love with Maid Marian because the fox had long eyelashes.
Well, not all of us. Some of us still worried about cartoons. But yeah, that's that sort of feature was one of the things that was strong. And you'd have maybe three or four films in a year. And then what happened was that we then got the video. We got our own projector and started showing a film a week. And then it moved. We got videos, and now we've got video machines in various parts of the base. And so people, it's a changing pattern. That's what happens, and these evolve. And the base magazines reflect more things that happened in the past than what's been happening in recent times there, because we've moved away from those, I think, to an extent.
And we used to give each other slideshows on Sunday as well.
Yeah.
And they were often very good, you know, because people have been on expeditions. And they
show
slides of something totally different, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see any women?
That was after my time. We didn't have women.
The Signy women, I don't know about, actually. I really don't know much about that. Maybe it's the fact that since women first started going down in the early 80s, early 80s, isn't it? Mid 80s. I'd set up was that I was going to put in the first women, and I'd approached Dick Laws, who was then the director, and he told me over my dead body. and I got the women in the season that he retired. Yeah. And Dave Drury took over, so it must be the mid-80s.
Val Jungman was the first.
And that was the point. I had originally set it up there, and I had gone to all the trouble of sorting it out to have women on the base. And it was going to be Dr. Debbie Oppenheim, a diatomist, and Sandra McInnes, my technician here. And they're going to be the first women going in for a summer at Signy. And it's suddenly, out of the blue, we decided the interviews went through, and a woman was appointed as the soil chemist. And the way it worked out with the shipping was that she was going. She went in ahead, and so she. Although we'd got set it up initially, it was going to be a couple of freshwater people would go in. It turned out it was a terrestrial scientist was the first woman to summer at Signy, and
for Christmas, which was a bit dubious.
That's right. Yeah, and our people came in the second half of the season. They came in January, so that must have been about 85, 86, somewhere around there. I think now I'm thinking about it, and subsequent to that, there's been obviously a large number of women have gone down, and we've actually had wintering women in recent times. And I suspect that that women's book is something that has evolved over the last 6 or 7 years, because I don't recall seeing it. No. The quote books stands right there. That the quote books is where anybody makes any stupid remark there, even if they haven't intended to be stupid, it ends up in the books.
It used to be really sort of quite witty, but it just got cruder and cruder, which spoilt it, you know, because it was good in the end.
It ended up there. I think you can trace it back to Harrison.
Paul Harrison.
Paul Harrison, Harrisburg. Paul Harrison went down, and he was one of these guys who was always getting fag ends. He always came in on a conversation halfway through and misunderstood it, and would then make some glorious remark there, which showed he was completely off the mark, and they went into the books. And it ended up that he was forever making these things, and everybody duly copied everything down. And that, in fact, is the point, from the point there where they virtually filled the book with Harrison's statements. The quote book went off, but before that, there were some remarkable lines in
there.
Do
you remember I got called out at my wedding?
Yes.
Bill Block sent a tell down to the base. Oh, you were there.
Yes.
Saying, did David say anything in the cookbook that I can use as ammunition at the reception? Because Bill was my best man. And
I was sitting next to the vicar, and Bill said, "Oh, we've had this message from the Antarctic. Apparently David in the quote book said, 'I've learnt a lot since I started reading Playboy.'" Oh, God.
Yeah. Yes, I think my classic line where I sent out a thing to Barry Hayward saying, "I'm having problems." My first two telexes went out month boards, and I said, I've really been having problems with these samples. I'm getting through there, but there's been a lot of problems with the sampling. There's a lot of problems with the weather conditions there, which aren't suitable for doing the kind of work I'm interested in. And he came back to me saying, "Bad weather is part of your contract." That's the sort of thing that went in. I have no idea about some dull thing I have said. And photo competition entries, there is a tremendous standard of photography amongst Bass staff in the field. They really are very, very high quality. Ed Lemon, a chemist working for me at Signy some years ago, he won the Best Young Photographer award there. And he was not necessarily the best photographer we had. He entered them and won the thing. But we have a competition every year, and there's a whole series of photographs they're taking. So we have scenes pictures of people, pictures of scenes, things like this. We also have some bizarre categories, is the Daphne M. Goodall Award. Daphne came down on the Lindblad, I think?
No, it was a Chilean one.
Was it Chilean?
Chilean tourist ship.
Yeah, came down on a tourist ship anyway. And she did this fast tour there of the Antarctic, took a series of excruciatingly bad photographs there and published them all in this little book she wrote of her account. And we, of course, got our hands on this. She characterised by taking a photograph, there would be an albatross flying a mile away. And she would have a 50mm lens on, or preferably a 28mm lens, yes. And would take this picture. And if you looked very carefully, there was this little fleck on it. And it became a characteristic that it had to be something that was, you didn't take it purposely.
No, had to be
you right. Actually took it. You know, like you say, you would take a picture, and you said, "There is a fantastic leopard seal just taking a penguin here, but a wave came up in front of it."
Yes.
And might just see a little bit of a leg of a penguin sticking out, and maybe the tail of the leopard seal. And the Daphne M. Goodall Award became one of the really high spots of the photographic competition.
The other classic. Can I just say this? Yeah. One that won it one year was when HMS Endurance was coming into Sydney. And the guy took the photograph just as an island got in the way. So all you can see is the mast. And it was outright winning.
There's the Prince Andrew Award. What are they calling it?
Technical incompetence,
that's right.
Yeah. As distinct from compositional incompetence.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen his book, but there's a classic one of a photograph of a windmill at the far side of a field. And his own shadow is right across the field.
Where is that? In which book?
He wrote a book of photographs, one of these royal books, you know, only published because it was him.
Wrong.
I mean, he's taken photographs of Trooping the Colour from the balcony of Horse Guards, and he's got a big chunk of balcony right in the foreground.
Yeah.
Absolutely appalling.
The only other one there, the log of cassettes and videos, no relevance, but the photograph of female staff, up to a few years ago when women started going into the Antarctic on a serious basis, and certainly coming into Signy there to not only summer but to winter, we used to get a photograph sent down each year of the female staff at the Bass HQ.
Mm.
And this would be duly sent down there to bolster the morale of the men on base there. Mm. And as that was about the only women you saw, other than the ones in Playboy and the rest of it was quite popular, didn't it? It used to come out and it used to go up onto the board. And it was nice to actually, some of the people you'd seen back in the UK, and it was nice to see their picture again.
Yeah. Thinking of the Playboy problem, we always had a water shortage problem at Signy Island. You either melted the snow, or you had to rely on, you know it's coming, you had to rely on the meltwater coming down during the summer. And there was always this awkward patch when there wasn't any snow and ice around, and there wasn't any meltwater because, you know, it just hadn't accumulated. And on the shower, we only had one shower a fortnight, that's all we were allowed. And we had to minimise the amount of water that you actually used when you were having a shower. So we had this virtually life-size picture on the outside of the shower of a stark naked man and woman embracing in a shower, and it just had the heading, "Save water, share a shower." And that was up there for a while, but eventually we had to take it down because we just couldn't stand the strain. But it was serious in those days, you know, the water just would not go around.
Because they were operating when I first went.
Yeah, base diaries used to be a regular thing that whoever was doing the night watch used to write up a diary of what was happening. And it was used a lot, very effectively there. For the end of the month, somebody had to write the base newsletter.
Mm.
And you wanted to know what everybody had done. And you're always desperate. There's always somebody who's a little bit quiet. And you're desperately trying to avoid saying he did his work again. Or, you know, he turned up for meals.
Mm.
Yeah, he is alive, mother. You know? And so this was a very useful way of doing it. And it worked very well for a while, but it actually did need people to make a positive commitment to writing it. And people eventually started to get out of doing it. They would just write any old rubbish in there, and they would forget days, and then they would make it up. And, of course, if you try and write it subsequently, that's exactly the problem with trying to write the month board.
Mm.
So that went by the way, but there was a lot of information in there about the everyday life on the base. The Folkehut journals are very interesting. In the early days, we actually used to maintain Met over at Folkehut, and in fact, there were a couple of people staying there, and there's a lovely sequence there when they actually had Husky over there, and he used to go and do his run down the coast with the dog, give the dog a walk, and he'd wander down. In fact, that guy who did that pulled out some really nice information about the lakes in those days. He used to make notes about them, and that's in the Folk Journal, and we've been able to use that subsequently to say things about how the lakes were in those early days. And subsequently, Folk became a jolly hut, and so people have... rather than working there, they were basically going over and just having a couple of nights, and people just make comments in there. It's particularly useful there that if people had to go out and search for somebody, they would go to the journal and check, because you should put in there your route back to the bay. And so that was one of the features that kept them going. But it's a standard thing that people would write down, sometimes writing pages and pages of philosophy and I don't know what else.
Descriptions of animal scene.
It's marvellous reading sit around an evening there with a nice warm drink there and just work through what people were doing 20, 30 years ago.
What was fun was your own entries were there.
Yeah.
And that's quite creepy, you know, because your mind, your approach changes. You know, particularly your first impressions are very vivid.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing sort of reliving what it felt like first time. Folkehut was definitely made from the remains of the Whalers Dormitory, 1921-23. Yeah. They took the wood over there and used it to build the hut.
That was an amazing hut there, because it had all this sort of lining, of felt lining, which was coming down off the roof, and there'd been generations of Fids had been cooking there, and there was fats and oils and all speakable filth. The hut itself was built onto the earth, in effect, there, and it had mats into it, which had sort of embedded themselves into the floor and become part of the floor. And every time there was a snow melt, the melt went straight through across the floor. So you would be walking around from bed to chair to table and trying to keep your feet off the ground there once you're taking off your boots. But it was a grubby sort of place, but it was I took responsibility for the hut the 2 years I was there, and it was a wonderful hut there to stay in, great character. It's been replaced by a much more modern affair, which is infinitely more comfortable. Water doesn't come through it. It's very, very nicely set up, and it's in actually a better view than the old one, but it lacks the character, and the entries reflect that it's now more of a holiday hut. And are just a passing through hut rather than the work tradition that was there. Because they used to have somebody on a bicycle, used to turn this bicycle, which powered a generator, which then powered up the radio so they could communicate. And at one point in time, there was also a telephone link. Yes. And for years, all throughout the 70s and the 80s, they'd abandoned this telephone link. The cabling was all over the ice cap, and so we're constantly picking up reels of this stuff and taking it back.
Just to trip over loops of it, because it'd be buried in the snow, and you know, you'd be walking, stepping into the snow itself, and you couldn't see the wire, and suddenly you wonder why you're flat on your face.
Yeah. The hunting lodge is actually... That is the old Gourlay hut, and that's down beside which cove?
It's it's on the Gourlay Peninsula, and
the cove
is near Filerhaven.
It's near Filerhaven,
where Roger Filer died.
That's right, and where his memorial is.
But the hunting lodge there is basically a large packing case, in effect. The remains of that were used to build, and it's two people can be accommodated there, a small table. And David Wynne took responsibility for that, because at the time that he was there, the terrestrial program, the Sydney Islands reference site, was based near Gole, on the Gole Peninsula, and it was these two Sir sites. And so this was a very neat place to go off. It's in amongst all the penguin colonies, and it's a delightful place if a little grubby.
That's right. It's a very good place for wildlife.
Very
and
good.
The logbook records that, you know, when people sighted the first seal and all that sort of thing. That's all in there as well.
It says something fair from just how poorly it compares in terms of its appearance to the other huts that it was given the grand name of the hunting lodge.
This is Files Travel, item 5. The tradition was to try and put in a South American trip when you went home, and after being south for 2.5 years, people were generous with leave, so I took 2.5 months coming home. And so I got off the ship in Montevideo and flew home from
Barbados. That was the tradition, wasn't it, that you actually went to South American ports? We didn't go to Stanley as our end of trip there, as the way we do now, because we didn't have the air bridge.
That's right. So Monte was the stopping off place, and we used to do these trips, and then as soon as we got back to UK, we'd type it up and get things straight back down to the base for the following season. So there was this tradition of passing on the tips about where to go, what not to go, what to eat, and
latest prices and things like this. And then you were only a year out of date.
Yeah.
And it was very much done from a FIDS viewpoint, and so it was very valuable information to put alongside what the South American handbook could offer you.
And this was one of the things about Sydney. It was very much a sort of family place. We were always trying to help each other in one way or another. People would take on different roles, like looking after the magazines or the records or something like that. And so, particularly in the days before videos, we'd entertain each other. And also there was this business of providing each other with information, either through slideshows or by writing these reports. Mm. It was a very tight-knit group. Right, we're talking about the record of telexes that came back during the Falklands War. I was at headquarters. Alan Hemmings was the biological assistant. I was the guy who appointed him. And he was very sensitive to the situation, very interested in politics. And he now actually works for ASOC, is it?
Yeah.
One of these organisations concerned with environmental issues and so on. He's very much a politician. And he put this remarkable collection of telexes together. I've got a copy of it, and some in the library as well. And he just kept a note of all the interactions that were going on. It was all a bit delicate because Sydney was a civilian base, not a military base, and Bransfield, civilian ship and so on. But obviously we were very concerned about the people who had been taken prisoner of war. You know, they were our civilians, if you like, and they were floating around the South Atlantic on the Valparaíso, which was the one that subsequently sank. But perhaps just put on tape my reactions here. I remember quite vividly a chap called Richard Crabtree, who was a geographer, a geologist, I think.
Now works at Perth School.
Perth School. He's head of geography there.
Yeah.
And he brought a little transistor radio in at lunchtime. And I remember, must have been sort of 12 o'clock news flash, that you know, the BBC had got wind of the fact that the Argentinians had invaded. And we all knew it was coming. I was editor of the Bass Club newsletter at the time, and I'd published a little article about the possibility of an invasion. And Enrique Ross, who was, I think, a foreign minister, had said he was going to prevent the Brits from having their 150th anniversary celebrations. And we all believed that. And it seemed to be the government who didn't believe it. And so when they did actually invade, part of the reaction was, well, we knew it was coming. And the second was, my God, they've actually done it. So that's what it was like at this end.
Yeah,
that
was the funny thing. I was on Sydney that summer, and having got onto the base, I'd been through in the 70s all these things like the Shackleton scare, and we'd had David Owen there had dispatched the submarine on another occasion.
Right.
And so to people who'd been down before, really the feeling was, is what can happen? You know, we weren't aware of all the detail that was back in the UK. We were just getting what we could over the World Service and what was coming through on the very few tells that were really coming our way with any information on it. And we had the impression this was just the Argentinians shouting again and nothing would come of it. And I can remember declaring there to say, well, there's no way they're going to do anything. And they promptly went and
invaded they did Falklands, wasn't it?
Yeah, it all started with the scrap merchants.
Yeah,
at least.
That's right. You know, we just didn't believe anything would happen, and in they went, and they make the first invasion, and then I said, well, that was big gesture and so forth. Nothing more will come from that. I can't imagine anything else happening there. It'll all quieten down. Next thing you know, they've taken the Falklands there, and then they went off and they were declaring themselves all over.
Yeah, South Georgia.
And there were people in the field. And
well, that's right. And that was the thing. We'd been talking with South Georgia quite actively, and it was, and I knew a lot of the people. And to then realise that we'd been talking with them, and then suddenly they went off the air, and the next thing we heard was an announcement there over the World Service that the Argentinians said that they had taken South Georgia, and that various British personnel had now disappeared off the face of the earth as far as we were concerned. And we were very concerned about that. And we were having talks with the Bransfield deciding what was going to happen, and eventually they decided the Bransfield would come up and pick us up. And in fact, I was one of the three married men who was down at the time, and I was only recently married there, and we were concerned there that we could actually inform our wives back in UK. And in fact, that was one of the things that to this day my wife has never forgiven them, because I was told there in the message there that when we got on board the ship, we would be allowed to talk in a brief, we'd have a brief message, would be sent out to say that they were okay. We got on board the ship, and we were then told that the Ministry of Defence had said that there was to be no communications with UK, and that we just stayed out of touch. We then disappeared off the face of the earth for the best part of a couple of weeks. And the next thing we heard was we were sailing up we moved over towards the South Sandwich Islands, and we're sailing up the coast of Africa, hearing on the World Service that British scientists had been, the Bransfield had been captured near the coast of Chile, there between Chile and Argentina. That area had been captured, and they actually were able to name the married people that are on board there, and our names came out. And because there was great concern here, and then when they came in to try and find out about it, they were basically told, we can't tell you anything. And it's in fact Bill Block who went up and got the information to say he's on the Bransfield, he is safe. Mm-hmm. But my last message from the base had been to say, I'm about to get onto the Bransfield. And we went, there was a great concern there, because we were all very concerned about the people at South Georgia. And there was, in fact, I remember being up in the early hours of the morning, and the crew were mainly Falkland Islanders, quite adamant they wanted to go to the Falkland Islands to see their families. And Stuart Lawrence out on the foredeck there arguing with them for a long, long time, must have been a good part of an hour, basically arguing to them the nonsense of the case and that we just couldn't go to the Falklands. That was just giving a great coup to the Argentinians. Mm. And I remember looking out and just wondering what was happening when you see that sort of thing going on. And then the talk there, that we were told that we were to head north. So we headed north with, as he put it, north with a lot of west in it. And so we curved around. And in fact, our feeling, having talked on the bit, was that potentially we could sneak into one of the fjords and get people ashore. We had enough people on board who knew the score, could actually have gone in and maybe pulled out the people who were in the field camps. Because a number of people at the base had been captured, but the people who had been already moved out to the field huts were still there.
And we felt
we could get them out. But then the announcement came up that the three Argentinian submarines being monitored by the Navy had disappeared. And we decided it was not a good idea to be around, and quite sensibly we moved away. And in fact, as it turned out, one of those submarines did appear at South Georgia.
And got sunk by Endurance.
And got sunk by the Endurance.
Santa Fe.
But certainly the memories of it there, it was a lot of confusion there and disbelief that that could be happening, because it had always happened like that in the past and come to nothing.
But Nick Barker gave many warnings about things that had accumulated, all sorts of warnings, things that just weren't normal. Like he was normally made very welcome when he went into Ushuaia, even though he's a Royal Navy ship, because the naval types, stick together, they're all sailors. And he got a very cool reception. He said that was completely out of character. And there were strings of warnings. I think he listed as many as 14 items, which just didn't fit. And unfortunately, the Admiralty thought he was just trying to save his ship, because they were trying to scrap her. And in fact, that was one of the reasons, I think, that the RGs decided to finally invade.
They thought...
Because they thought the Royal Navy were pulling out of the Antarctic, and therefore this was their one opportunity to get in there and do something about it.
Well, the Foreign Commonwealth Office had been given all the signals as well. Yeah. They admit that now. They were giving all the right signals.
Yeah. I mean, Galtieri was a fool, but everything was encouraging them to do it. Now is your chance of all time.
Yeah.
Made a big difference.
Together.
Oh, I see.
This completes our recording of the history of the Signy memorabilia.